Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I had a lot of people ask for this guest to come back and finally have her back on. Artie Six Killer Clark is on tonight talking about her new book, More Encounters with Star People, Urban American Indians Tell Their Stories. And I think we're going to follow this one up sometime in the near future with an interview, well, not an interview, with a roundtable talking about the implications of some of the data in this book. It's a very good book. I liked her last one. This one's really, really interesting. She has a wide diversity of cases, and there's some connections to a lot of other stuff going on. We may do a roundtable about some of this stuff in the very near future. This is out on Anomalous Books, anomalousbooks.com. They have all kinds of great stuff. You may notice we have a lot of guests from Anomalous because he puts out great stuff. All right. If you were a patron, you already got this show back pretty much. I think I put it up the night I did it on Tuesday night. And I do that whenever I can for patrons as well. You got a patrons-only show from Project Archivist. Now, I had done that with them. It was just for their patrons, and they allowed me to put that up for you guys as well. I also have, we had done an Ask Us Anything in the patron forum, and one of the questions was for a Red Pill Junkie, and I have that, which is going to be going up in a few days as well. If you want to become a patron, it's only $3 a month. It helps us out greatly on the show here. Just go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. And I want to thank everyone who has become a patron, everyone who's not a patron, who just listens to the show, everyone who spreads the word, all our very vocal listeners on YouTube. Thank you all. I can't say that enough. I really can't. All right. Without any further ado, this is Artie Six Killer Clark here on Where Did the Road Go? And I welcome back to the show Artie Six Killer Clark, and we're going to be talking about her new book, More Encounters with Star People, Urban American Indians Tell Their Stories. And Artie, this is your third book on UFOs?
Yes, yes.
And this is out on Anomalous Books. This is the second one on Anomalous, right?
Right.
And this is Native Americans who do not live on reservations, correct?
Right. That's okay. Right.
And this book is fantastic. You've collected such a variety of stories here.
Well, you know, that was my intent. I looked at the various themes in ufology literature, and then I tried to, identify stories in my collection that were similar in nature to what, say, mainstream had reported. And I think it gives validity to the things that other people are saying.
Yeah. Now, do you see a difference between the encounters with Native Americans and non-Native Americans?
I think the major difference is that there has been a historical a history of encounters with star people by Native people. And so they're much more open and more accepting of these events that occur because they've occurred in the past. The children have been told the ancient stories of their people about interaction with star people and earth people. And so it doesn't come as big a surprise to them in many cases as what it has, what it does in mainstream society.
Yeah. The descriptions are also more varied, I've noticed. Like, you're not getting just grays. You're getting all kinds of descriptions. And
right.
It feels to me more like what we were getting out of the mainstream UFO culture in, like, the 1960s.
I don't know if it's limited to the 1960s, but, you know, you have experiences with reptoids, you have experience with grays, you have experience with people who look just like them, as they describe us, say, well, what do they look like? Well, they look just like us, you know.
Yeah.
You have experience with shape-shifting, where it appears as one thing and becomes another. So there's a variety of different entities that appear to be involved. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed throughout my interviews is that many of the people say, well, these are not the people, the star people of our history. These people are dangerous, or these entities, I should say, or beings are dangerous. Our people interacted with star people who were helpful and who brought knowledge to us and who shared with us in an equal way. I mean, they even intermarried mm-hmm. with star people. And now you have those kind of stories as well, but you also have those that are taken against their will, that are abducted, that experiments are performed on them. You have just a variety of events that are going on, and they make it clear that, you know, there seems to be a difference, whether there's more advances in science from different entities out there in space that they're able to come here, or whatever is going on. You will find a large variety of experiences in this book.
Now, none of these accounts, if I'm not mistaken, none of these are remembered via hypnosis. These are all consciously remembered.
None of them.
Okay. And how do these people find you?
A lot of it is through word of mouth, you know, that I collect stories, and some of them comes from relatives. I even get emails from people saying, you know, this is what's going on. Would you come visit with us? Because, you know, I started out collecting traditional star stories. I was very interested in the star stories of the tribal groups out here in the West, because I had heard star stories as a child, and I was so interested, and I was in a position where I could collect these stories, and I did. And then one day, an elderly lady said to me, well, you know, you should also be collecting contemporary stories, because there's a lot of those stories out here. And I said, well, do you have a story? And she said, yes, I do. Hmm. And so I recorded her story. And she said, and I'll tell you somebody else who's had an experience. And so it's just kind of spread by word of mouth that I collected stories. And wherever I would go, people would a lot of times it's by chance. When I tell people what I do, what I'm interested in, they will refer me to a cousin, an uncle, an aunt, or they themselves may have a story. So it has just grown enormously over the years, and I've literally collected hundreds and hundreds of stories.
Now, is there any stigma attached, or I should say, is there as much of a stigma as attached in the Native American culture as there is in, like, the general American culture?
Well, I think there is, you know, maybe not to that extent, but there's not as much talk about it in Native cultures. People who talk to me, the majority of them, I would say, told me they had never told anybody else, or mm. only a close relative. They keep it in the family. But definitely there is a fear of being labeled being weird or unstable. They don't want their stories up on Facebook and Twitter and all those kind of things. That's a big no-no. They don't want any advertisement about who they are. And spoke to me only on the guarantee of anonymity. So I would say in many of the tribal cultures, there's a lot of teasing. In my first book, these two police officers that encountered a space craft and these entities, reported it at their police station, and they said, when we die, they're going to put on our tombstones, you know, something about the little green men. And they were just teased unmercifully by their fellow officers. So that's a concern that they have, you know, that they'll be teased. And it's good teasing, but also it gets pretty old to the people who are the object of the teasing. So there's a varied reasons for people keeping quiet.
Right.
And then a lot of them come forward because they want their story told, because they see that there's a threat out there.
Right.
And they don't want to personally take on the responsibility of informing people who they are and come out publicly, but they want the warning to be out there.
Well, let's talk about one of the stories. Let's do a Watcher in Death Valley.
Okay. One of my favorite stories. Met this man when I was camping out, and he has certainly over time has become a good friend, and I was traveling to the Star Trek convention down in Las Vegas when I stopped off and spent the night in Death Valley, and Jim Greydog, I had settled in and I had walked out toward the fringes of the park there, looking for a good place to observe the sky, when this boy said, you know, called out to me, and he told me that that he was a self-appointed watcher of UFOs. He himself, along with a number of high school friends, had been abducted when he was young, and he saw them as being all-powerful. They could change form. They could even imitate the image of his classmates. And they were all taken on board, and it had serious impact on all of their lives. One of the women could never have a child, and she blamed it on these creatures. And two of them actually became watchers. He was only one of them. He had a good friend that was also a watcher. But what he did is he recorded the events of abduction that took place in and around Death Valley. And he told me, he showed me a notebook where he kept detailed accounts of who was abducted, what they were wearing, approximately how old they were. He had a description of them, and when they were, the date of their abduction, and if they returned or not. So he kept a pretty detailed account of each one of the abductions. And that's the reason he called out to me, because he said that I was standing in this place where he had seen others abducted, and he was fearful that that was not a safe place for me. And he was quite an amazing man. I think everything he told me was true.
And he did say some of these people had disappeared and hadn't come back.
Right.
Or at least not that he saw.
Right. Not that he saw. Whether they were deposited someplace else or whether they were kept. You know, I have been told that by some people that they've been given an option of whether they want to go with them or not. They choose people that have really no connections to the earth, no relatives, no one who would really miss them, and that they disappear. And one of the things I find fascinating when you look at missing persons records, you say about 50% of missing persons are accounted for. They're either runaways, or they've met with foul play, or, you know, there's some explanation for their disappearance. Mm-hmm. But 50% are never found, and their disappearance is never explained. And when I listen to some of the people talk about how individuals just disappear. Or the lady in my book who talks about going with her daughter and her mother to another planet, and it has all been planned out, and women all over the world are going through the same thing. It just makes you stop and think about what is going on in this universe.
Yeah, and she just disappeared. I mean, you were talking to her, and then she just kind of like disappeared, and you have no idea what happened to her.
No idea what happened to her. And she had no other relatives than her mother and her daughter. And she told me she was going.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
There was also the account from World War II where the guy's partner there was
right
taken, and they said that's because he was going to die and no one was going to miss him.
Right. And they told him, we knew you were going to survive the world.
Hmm.
But Antonio wasn't going to survive. And so that's the reason we took him, and we kept him. And he stays.
Okay, let's look at the one that's called There Are Many Alien Species.
Yeah. Jimmy, he was an elder that I met, and he told me that there are more than one alien species coming here. Well, if you listen to the stories of the people who've had these encounters, obviously, you know, that's true. There are all kinds of different species coming here. What their intent is, Jimmy's concern was what was their intent. He doesn't think that they all have, that some of them are aggressive, that some of them are intent on conquering Earth, that some of them are already here. He said that he watched them shapeshift right before his eyes when he was at the barn of his neighbor. And he said they took an old 55 Chevy that was stored in the barn, and they drove off.
And they had taken that family numerous times as well, right?
Yes, and the girl, the teenage girl, thought she was, you know, the father thought she was pregnant. And they had moved because they realized that something unearthly, was the word that Jimmy used, had, you know, was involved, and they thought they could escape. But and so Jimmy was taking care of their place and their livestock. He actually bought all their livestock, and he was telling me how they could shapeshift and the different things that were going on at that ranch.
Hmm. And that's the one where there was like a burned circle on the ground too, where
right,
the UFO came down.
Right, and it glowed. And when night came, he took me there, and we walked. We walked near the circle, and you could see it—the faintly glowing circle.
So it still glowed. It still glowed.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, faintly, but it still glowed. You could make out the outline of the circle.
Now, in a number of these stories, you have them talking about how they can control minds. And it makes me wonder if we can assume that anything we're seeing is real, if they can actually control what we see.
Well, and that's a good question, and I think it's one that probably we should explore. I think what many of my interviewees have told me is that it only works on about 80 to 85% of the population. And in some cases, they use drugs, and in others, they simply use their mind. But the aliens themselves admit that it doesn't work on everyone. But they aren't concerned about the percentage that it doesn't work on, because they frankly tell them that nobody's going to believe you anyway.
Yeah.
And... But whether they are implanting ideas in their mind, I'm not sure. But even if that is the case, then they still exist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? So if they're implanting ideas, they would you know.
My personal view is that, I mean, these people seem honest. The people I've talked to that have had experiences seem honest. I've had experiences. I don't tend to doubt people's stories. I think these things happen. I doubt the interpretations of them sometimes because I think we're dealing with something we don't fully understand, and our mind may make leaps. They may be able to control some of that or influence some of that. They could be something completely different from what they're coming down as. And maybe aliens is the way that they're presenting themselves now.
Well, you know, that may be true. I don't know. If they're aliens, why would they present themselves? You know, the thing that I think, you know, is quite possible is that if there are aliens among us, as some of the people I've interviewed believe that to be true, mm-hmm. then they're able to take the form of human beings. Now, one of my interviewees told me about these balls of light that could transform themselves into anything they wanted to be, whether it was human or whether they revealed themselves as in their true characteristics, or they could be an inanimate object and nobody would even know about, you know, that it was an alien that was observing. So it's rather interesting to think about that and to speculate on that, because if that's the case, we wouldn't know if our next door neighbor is from another world.
True. Although some of us probably have suspicions.
Right. You may be right there.
All right, let's look at an event in the Everglades.
Oh, that's an interesting story because, I had heard about or read about the event that happened with James Flynn from Fort Myers, Florida, who went into the Everglades with his four dogs, and he was just a few miles from the Big Cypress Indian Reservation when all of a sudden his dogs jumped out of the boat and started chasing a deer, and he waited and waited for his dogs to return, and he finally got out of his swamp buggy and he headed in the direction where he saw them. And then the story goes that, you know, he spotted this huge light in the sky above the cypress trees, and this object appeared about 4 feet off the ground. The people who checked out his account said there was a huge burned area and scorched tops of 25-foot cypress trees and scrape marks 4 feet off the ground. He himself fell unconscious. He woke up about 24 hours later and made his way to the home of a Seminole Indian friend, and by this time he had only partial sight in his left eye and was blind in his right eye. And I was really interested in this story, and I happened to be down in that area, and so I had contracted with a Seminole Indian man to take me on a tour on an airboat to this area, and I told him I was interested in seeing the site where James Flynn had encountered the UFO, and he said, "I know the story." He said, "My father told me about it when I was a boy," and he was really reluctant to talk to me. And you know, I asked him if he had ever had an encounter, and he kind of said, you know, accusingly, "So you can include me in your next book," he said. And he said, "No, thanks. I'm not interested in being in a book." And we traveled, you know, we continued on, and I didn't say anything. And finally he came to this area, and he said Flynn's encounter was in that area, and he pointed in the direction, but he said it's not a good idea to get out of the boat because he said you don't want to run onto an alligator. And then he finally kind of loosened up, and he said, "Do you swear you won't tell anyone what I tell you?" And I said, "No, I will not. I will not tell anybody that you told me." And he said it was common to see these mysterious lights over the Everglades. He said there's hardly a month goes by that there's not a sighting, but he said they don't make the news because we just don't talk about them. And he said a few months ago, he said, I got a call from Ben. He said, he's a friend of mine, and he was asking me to come to his rescue. And apparently Ben was in the tour business like him, but he said that night Ben had taken his two sons out for an evening, and something happened to the boat, their boat, and he couldn't get it started. And so he asked Billy if he would come to his rescue. And he said he headed out immediately, and he said as he got on the water, he said he tried calling him once or twice, and he got no response. He said his cell phone went dead, and his GPS malfunctioned, as anything else could happen, and he said it was about that time that he saw a beam of light appear above me. And I said, well, did you know the source of the light? And he said, I knew it was aerial because it was coming from overhead. But he said, you know, I had never had an experience where these beams from a spacecraft would come so close to me. And he said it wasn't long before I saw the outline of their ship. And he said there were blue lights that outlined it. And he said then they just zoomed away. And he said once the craft was gone, he said, I found Ben. And that was a strange part, he said. When I arrived at the boat, he was sound asleep, and his sons were missing. And I said, missing? And he said, yeah, they were nowhere in sight. And he said, I tried to wake up my friend, but he seemed delirious. And he said, so I just headed out trying to find those boys, kind of circling back and forth through the waters there. And he said, I would stop, and I would call for them. And he said, just as he was about to give up, he heard this faint cry, and he said he headed toward the sound, and there on a small island, he said, no bigger than my boat, he said he saw the boys naked, huddling together. And I said, well, where were their clothes? And he said, well, I never found them. And he said, I didn't spend a lot of time looking either. He said, I got the boys in my craft, gave them blankets, and headed back toward their father, who was... And his father was still disoriented and not even aware of his surroundings. Hmm. I said, well, did you ever find out what happened to the boys? And he said, well, I stayed with them until the sun came up, and then I accompanied them back to the dock. And he said, by that time, the father appeared to have made a full recovery, and he told about this spacecraft that hovered overboard them, shining a spotlight. And he tried to outrun them, but he couldn't. And the boys had no recollection of what happened to them. They didn't know where their clothes was. But both of them, he said, had a large circular red mark on their necks and a small red mark on their shoulders, about the size of a silver dollar, he said. Hmm. And I said, well, did they remember how they got it? And he said, they have no recollection. So that was the story he told me. He said, I believe they were abducted by aliens. I believe they disabled Ben and abducted the boys. There is no other explanation, he said, because I saw the craft myself as it left the Earth.
Wow.
Interesting story, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very interesting story. One of the, I guess the encounter that near the end of the book called A Strange Encounter at Joe's Place is essentially a
one
man
of my favorite stories, and Joe is one of my favorite characters too.
It's basically a Men in Black encounter.
In part, yes, because Joe owned this small convenience store gas station on the edge of the reservation, and he also had a little pizza shop in this place. And in the afternoons or evenings, it was a hangout for the teenagers. But on the weekends, all these families came because Joe had what he claimed to be the best pizza in the state. And he said that one night He said it was common that because he didn't have a lot of seating area, I think I was there and ordered a pizza, and there were only about 6 or 7 tables in this place, so very crowded. He said that the people were very respectful of one another. When they would pull up, they would stay parked outside his place, and then his cousin, who worked for him, would go outside and tell the next couple or family to come in that they had a table free. And so people just accepted that they would have to sit in their cars until there was space for them to come into the little pizza place. And he said that on one particular night, there was a man who walked into the pizza place, and he didn't follow this protocol of waiting for his turn. And he said he was extremely tall, and he said he was dressed in what he said looked like a ski outfit, he said, a one of those one-piece suits. And he said that he was a very tall, big man. He had light blonde hair, almost white, and blue eyes. And he said he had some kind of an insignia, he said, on the coveralls that he was wearing. And I said, well, can you describe it? And he told me it was a diamond shape with some kind of odd figures underneath it. He said, I didn't recognize them. They made no sense to me. And he said that he never really spoke, but he pointed. And when his cousin asked him what he wanted, she thought he wanted tea. And so she brought him this boiling pot of water, and he drank it while it was boiling hot. And then he took his spoon and he ate all the sugar in a sugar bowl. And she goes back and she tells Joe, you can't believe this, what this guy just did. So he takes a pot of hot tea out and refills the sugar bowl, and he did the same thing. And he asked him, did he want something else? And he pointed to the menu that it was displayed above the counter. So Joe made him a pizza. And he took it to the back, to one of the back table, and sat down. Well, but this time, people in the shop are starting to notice this strange character that's there. And one woman said he told her that he could control her, and she felt it so strongly. And she didn't even finish her. The family just trying to gather up their pizza and get out of there because they were so intimidated by this person. And another one said he made it so she couldn't move. And he told her, that's just the beginning of what I could do to you. And Joe told me, he said, you know, I never paid much attention to all this UFO stuff. He said, but I do believe this man was not human. He said he scared the hell out of me and out of the people in my dining room. And he said, but I fooled him. He said when he left, he levitated the vehicle off the ground that he drove in on, and it flew upward into the sky. And he said that he had the ability to create illusions, I believe, when he mingled among humans. And he said, but I fooled him. I remembered. He told me that I wouldn't remember. He said, but I fooled him. I remember what happened. And not only that, there are two other people who remembered. And he said that there was a farm lady down the road. And he said she thinks he thinks she is the one that called the base. You know, there's a military base about 60 miles from there. And he said, and then these men show up demanding what happened that night, and he told him nothing happened. And I said, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, I'm not talking to any government men. I'm not telling them anything. And of course, they were warning him that, you know, if it was ever discovered that he was not telling the truth. And of course, he wasn't intimidated by that at all. But he said one thing he was wrong about us. He's talking about this strange man. He said his power doesn't work on everyone. Hmm. And that seems to be the case with a lot of the people that I've interviewed, that they were able to maintain their ability. You know, I interviewed one woman, and she said, I just repeated the national anthem or America the Beautiful to myself. And that way I could observe them because they couldn't control my mind.
Hmm. And, one of the things you mentioned is that sometimes people smell something when they're on the ships, and they speculate that that might be what's putting people under.
That's right. That's exactly right. That there's a smell. It in some cases it irritates their eyes. It irritates their nose. Other people don't seem to have. It doesn't seem to impact them. And those are basically the people who are aware of what's going on. In the one story of the PhD, I talked to a guy who, he and his friends had just completed their doctoral programs and went out in the woods one night to celebrate their graduation and drink some beer and eat some pizza and spend the night in the woods. And there were six of them that did this. And out of the six, only one, the one who talked to me, was the one who remembered what had happened. So he's on board with all of his friends and trying to get them to wake up or to react in some way. And they're just totally out of it. And, you know, he's so confused by what's going on.
Was there a common description of the smell, or was it different?
A lot of them talk about a sulfur smell. Some of them talk about a metallic smell. Hmm. I would say that most of them talk about a metallic smell, which might say that it was some kind of chemicals, you know, that they were using to put them to sleep.
And didn't someone describe, like, burning electronics?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So, it's different species may have different things that they can use, you know, the mind, some kind of chemicals that put them to sleep.
One of the bits I found amusing in relation, like the story you were just telling where he was trying to wake up his friends, you tell a story about a woman who... when she wakes up on the ship, she sees a bunch of people there, and she starts basically slapping them around. And I think you said, well...
Right, kicking their shins and everything else.
And I think you said something...
And it was just, you know, I thought, wow, you're beating up on everybody on the ship. Because she couldn't understand why she was the only one that was aware of what was going on.
Yeah, I think you actually phrased it as when you got done beating up the other victims.
Right. That was a question I asked her. You know, when you got through beating up on, because she kept telling me, I went to this person, I went to this one, and I kicked his shins or I pulled her hair, you know. And I'm just thinking, I can't imagine, you know, what was going on, you know, because these people are totally unaware of where they are, apparently. And she was the only one that knew what was going on.
And when they woke up with bruises, they were assuming it was the aliens.
They probably thought the aliens did it to them.
Okay, let's look at abductions of an unusual kind. And this kind of relates into the whole cattle mutilation thing.
This is
the one with the polar bears.
Oh, yeah. That was quite a story, you know. This guy who had an engineering consulting company had been hired by the government to do a job up in Alaska, which apparently involved setting a whole series of cameras and monitoring equipment of some kind of government facilities, or I'm not sure. Maybe it was the pipeline. I don't know. All he told me was it was, he couldn't tell me what it was. But he told me about this he was on the phone with an operator someplace that was checking out the equipment as they were installing it. And it, you know, they had put in like 14-hour shifts, and he had told his guys to go on home, that he would do the final check, and he would see them tomorrow. And just as he was walking around, apparently turning off some lights and was headed to his vehicle, all of a sudden, the whole night, he said it was just like a Christmas tree. A whole night lit up like, you know, a Christmas village, he said. And these lights were coming from overhead of different colors. And he said he started to run for his truck, and he was thrown to the ground and literally paralyzed. And he said, but he was aware, you know, of what was going on and the sounds around him. And that's when he heard the sound of a polar bear in distress that was running. And he saw a beam of light land on this polar bear and pull it up into a craft, the polar bear struggling. And he saw actually two of them abducted. And once they were abducted, they just disappeared, and the craft disappeared. And he said the next morning when he went back to the job, the polar bears were about 100 feet away from where he saw them abducted. And they had been killed, and different parts of their body had been removed. And it was an interesting thing, because later on he and his men are abducted, and his men again are unaware of where they are and what's going on, and they took him into an area where they put something over his head, and they told him they were taking his knowledge. All the knowledge that he had, and he was very distraught about that. What right they had to do that, and they told him, you know, well, you have no right to resist this. And as he was leaving, he actually saw the carcass of a whale being with these aliens surrounding it, and were apparently performing similar surgical procedures on this whale. It was a powerful story, but one that, you know, I've been told about crocodile being taken on board. I've been told about buffalo. I've been told about a moose, a mm-hmm. dog, and now polar bears. And I keep thinking about, you know, all of these creatures, you know, like it's common, you know, in the one story in the book where the deputy sheriff sees a cow that's mutilated. And, you know, that's common because ranchers check on their herds and they find their dead cattle. But, you know, who would be out there in Alaska in this isolated region that nobody even knows that exists, and polar bears are taken, or in the woods where a moose is taken?
Now, the polar bears...
Or even a crocodile.
Yeah, but they found the polar bears afterwards mutilated, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And it made the workers very upset because, you know, they have a lot of stories up there about hairy men that do terrible things. And so they were, you know... His workers were quite frightened.
Understandably.
Yeah.
Another one from Alaska you tell is a UFO at the top of the world.
I know. Isn't that a wonderful story?
Yeah.
And an interesting story because, you know, this man who told me this story worked at the college there. I had gone there to interview for a job. As the president of the College of the North Slope, and of course, after I was in Barrow for one day, I knew that was where I was going to be for the rest of my life. But Barrow is one cold, cold place, and you know, the only way you can get out of there is by plane, and you are at the mercy of Mother Nature. And when I went there for an interview, I was supposed to be there for 3 days. And I ended up spending a week because the weather moved in, and I couldn't get out. No planes could come in and no planes could go out. And I was in this restaurant. The only restaurant in town, at least at that time, was a place called Pepe's North of the Border. And it was a Mexican restaurant up there, and that's where everybody congregated. The oil workers would stop off there. I mean, I met some interesting characters there. It reminded me of what it must have been like in the gold rush days in Alaska. But he approached me, and he said, you know, I work at the college. I saw your interview. I was part of you. I sat in on one of your interviews, he said, and I hope you will come here and be our leader, he said. But I heard last night, I was in here, and I heard this man telling you this story about a UFO encounter. He said, but I'll tell you the real story, he said. I'll tell you a real one. And he began to tell me about being out at the college one night. He worked late. And one of the common things they do when they're driving, and of course the college was a former naval base that had been donated to the people there, and they turned it into a college. The Navy apparently had no further use for it, and so they used it for a college, and they set up a college system there. And so it was outside the town of Barrow. Maybe a 5-10 minute drive, maybe a 5-mile drive, I mean, maybe 10 miles. But they would watch, they would tell you, you know, when they brought me back, you know, they said, now, roll down your window, and we want you to watch the telephone poles, because if we have to stay between the telephone poles. And his driver said, I'll watch it on my side, you watch it on your side, because we want to stay inside the telephone poles, because if we don't, we could end up on the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to do that. We don't want to drive out on the sea. So anyway, he was telling me how he had rolled down the window. He was watching the telephone poles. And all of a sudden, he said, this bright light appeared in front of him, and he saw a spacecraft actually land. And he said he sat there for a few minutes, and he said all of a sudden he saw this humanoid figure walking toward him. He said he couldn't make out anything about the figure other than he had two legs and a head and two arms because of the glare of the light, and he was like silhouetted into the light. But what he started to hear was cold, the word cold, and this creature seemed to be indicating to him telepathically, cold. And he said it was like 70 below zero, and it was blizzard-like conditions. And he said all of a sudden he turned around and got back in the craft, and they flew away. And he said that it just must have been too cold for him is all I can say. But he said that he told me another story about his uncle who was seal hunting and had gone out and actually saw a spacecraft and four little men that were outside the spacecraft. And his uncle thought it was so strange because they were dressed in these silver suits that reflected the sun. And his uncle had said it was so strange because they don't know how to dress for this weather. Because, you know, you want to wear clothes that absorbs the heat of the sun, not reflects the heat of the sun. So
yeah.
His uncle thought it was very strange.
Huh. That's just
some interesting stories come out of Alaska. You know, there's an old story, an ancient story that was told to me by an elder up there by the name of Uncle Mo. And Uncle Mo had a fish camp on the Tanana River, and he would take me up there, and we'd sit, and he would tell me stories. And he told me about an ancient story about the men with tails. Mm. And they were reptilian-like creatures that were cannibalistic and who lived near the village of his people. And that others would come and join them in celebration and eat humans, and they would come from the sky. And so his people plotted a way to destroy them. those who were living in this nearby village, and he said they never returned after that, but he said, we always keep watch, and we tell our children to keep watch. Interesting story, huh? So
yeah.
They're reptilian stories from ancient Alaska, too.
And you would think reptilians would have issues with that kind of cold, being cold-blooded.
You would.
I mean, unless they're not cold-blooded.
Right. You know, we assume they are because that's what they are here on Earth.
Yeah. Let's look at a fairly simple one that I thought was interesting, which is I met my wife on a UFO.
Yes, that's another interesting story. I was working with this young man. He was in charge of an alternative school for high-risk youth, he had come to the university looking at perhaps enrolling in our doctoral program in educational leadership, and he was referred to me by the department head. And one day I was up visiting with him, and he was aware that I collected stories, and we're sitting in the cafeteria. There's no one else there. And he says, you know, I never told you this, but he said, I met my wife on a UFO. And I was pretty shocked. And I thought, you know, he's joking. And I looked at him, and he was just dead serious. He led me out back to the ball court. They had a small ball court back there. And he began to tell me about being abducted when he was a young boy. And he said that he always watched the stars, and he'd climb up on the roof of his house, and he would wait, and he had seen a number of UFOs. This particular night he was abducted. He was taken into this large room, he said, where there were dozens and dozens and dozens of other children about his age. And he said that he was aware of what was going on, and there were three boys that he spotted that were aware of what was going on. And he approached them, and they were teasing him because he was wearing these underwear that had red devils on them, black underwear with red devils, and they started teasing him what he was doing in his underwear. And he just kind of left the group and started milling around, and he saw this young girl that... he just fell in love with her, he said, on the spot. And years later, when he was in high school, he saw her again, and he knew immediately she was the one. And then at some point, he tells her how he knows she's the one, and he describes the dress she was wearing that night. And she's just astounded because she goes into her... she has a cedar chest, and she pulls out this dress, and she brings it to him, and she shows it to him, and she said, I only wore this dress twice. My father gave it to me for my birthday, and so I wore it to my birthday party. And then the next time I wore it was to my father's funeral. And then I put this dress away, and I've never worn it since. She had no recollection of being abducted. But his story convinced her that something truly had happened to her, you know, and he was convinced that, and he even thought that the aliens proved of him becoming her partner. And his abductions have continued over the years.
Okay, I think we have time for maybe to squeeze a couple in real quick here. Let's do a deputy sheriff's encounter.
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting story because this deputy sheriff, he was... he worked for the county sheriff's department, but his grandfather lived on the reservation. And he... I had known his grandfather for a very long time. I had never met him, but I'd known his grandfather for a long time, and he stopped me on the highway and gave me a hard time, was giving me a hard time because apparently he knew who I was, and I didn't know who he was. And But when he told me that Percy was his grandfather, he followed me out to Percy's ranch, and I had gone out with food I was going to cook for Percy, and I'd like to go out and I'd stay overnight at his place. I'd take food and cook for him because he was by himself at the time when I knew him. You know, I didn't know he had a grandson. Well, anyway, to make the story short, you know, as he's driving to his grandfather's place, he comes up over this hill on the highway, a two-lane highway, and there's a spacecraft parked in the middle. He said it covered the whole two lanes. And about the same time, his engine stops on his vehicle, and the lights go out, and the radio quits. He gets his gun, and he's trying to determine what he should do. And he gets his gun, gets out of the truck, and he gets down in the borrow pit that runs along. He said it was about 6 feet deep. And just as he was getting ready to start go investigate and walk toward the craft, he heard these sounds. And he said it was a garbled kind of noise, like he said he thought they were communicating. He said some of the sounds were like hisses, but he couldn't make out any syllables, and he couldn't make out any language that he had ever heard. And he saw these lizard-like creatures that were exploring, and he said out in the field was a cattle herd. And he said that all of a sudden the cattle started to run, and he said that he saw them go in that direction. He stayed hidden, and finally, after they were gone, he goes in to where the herd was and finds this cattle, this steer mutilated. And he races back to his vehicle, and just as he gets back to his vehicle, he hears these helicopters. He said he knew the sound of helicopters. And he drives to his grandfather's place with his lights out because he didn't want to get stopped by the military, because there was a military base about, 80 to 100 miles away. And when he gets to his grandfather's place, his grandfather is up in the middle of the night, which was rather common for him. This happened about 3 o'clock in the morning. The grandfather was upset because his television set wasn't working, and he had, I think it was Dish Network is what he had, and he said his television was nothing but a pink screen, and he was upset, and he said he couldn't talk to anybody about it because he'd be talking to somebody in the Philippines, and how would they know that a spacecraft went over and ruined his TV reception? So it was an interesting a recollection of something that had happened.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And he was quite detailed because, you know, he's a deputy sheriff who, you know, he was well educated. He had a college degree. His sense of detail was extraordinary, you know, in terms of what he saw and what happened.
Yeah. Okay, let's close off with actually the opening story in the book, Traveling the Universal Highway.
Tom, one of my favorite characters of all that I ever interviewed. I met him by chance up in northern Montana on my way to Writing on the Stone Provincial Park up in Canada. Right over the border from Montana. He told me the story about when he was in Iraq. He said that he joined the military because he felt patriotic and that he was concerned that America had been attacked. And he no sooner got, he said, in country than all of a sudden they're shipped out to this remote area of Iraq where reportedly Saddam Hussein had been seen. And he said when they got there, it was like an ambush, and they were getting fired on from all directions, and this one sniper on this building was just really shooting all around him. And he stumbles into this vacant building looking for some kind of safety. And all of a sudden, the floor, the sand just started to swirl around him. And when it clears, he's in a cavern-like tunnel, and there is a being standing there beckoning him to follow him. And he comes into an area, he said it was the size of several football fields, and inside was this huge spaceship. And the being welcomes him on board and asks him to go with him, and they'll take him to safety. And when he tells them that he can't do that, that's desertion, that he has to stay with his comrades, they find this very confusing. And then they tell him, well, if you won't go with us, we'll be here tomorrow too, and if you come and want to go, we'll take you away. And he said that when he was a boy, he said there's this universal highway, and this universal highway, you step into it, and you can go wherever you want to go just by thinking about it. And he said that's how spacecraft travel, this universal highway, and why they don't need, scientists say, well, if they can travel, how do they get here? And he says that's how they get here. And he says there's openings all over the world. And the universal highway connects planets and different places on Earth, and so that you can travel. He told me about one time camping there, and a starman came through, and he took him throughout the Montana and the Dakotas and Wyoming. And they visited all the Indian reservations and, participated in ceremonies. And he said, everywhere I took him, people knew he was a star man, but nobody questioned his existence or why he was there. They called him brother and welcomed him into their ceremonies. And he said, that's the way it is with the real star people. They're just like us. So that was his story. Now, I often think, about Tom, every time I think of him, he seems to appear on my doorstep. What's for dinner, he'll say. I think, is he a star traveler too? Is he from another planet? I'm still reserved on that. One day I'm going to ask him.
Well, so how many stories do you have that you haven't published?
All over 1,000.
Will you ever publish them, or are you just going to keep
it? Well, I'm working on a fourth book. I've been going through my files looking for stories that are really extraordinary, where it changed people's lives. I mean, dramatic changes, like career changes, life changes, that kind of thing. And so far I've found, a couple dozen where people have talked about how their lives have changed. Not as simple like, well, now I know they exist out there, so my life, I know that we're not alone in this universe. I'm talking about where they made a drastic change in their lives, like changed their career or their family was so impacted that changed the family unit, things of that nature. So I'm thinking of writing a book about extraordinary encounters that changed people's lives. But I, considering my age and considering my health, I'm not so sure that I'll be able to ever publish all of them, because I continue to collect stories, and will until I walk the Milky Way. So, I don't think I'll ever be able to tell all of them.
Right. And you are doing a series of or another children's book, right?
Yes, I've been working on children's books and looking for a publisher.
Oh, okay.
So if there's anybody out there that publishes children's books, give me a call. Send me an email. And for your listeners, too, please, if you want to write, you want to tell me about your experiences, if you have read my book and you want to talk to me about it, just email me at ardy@sixkiller.com, and I answer every email personally.
Okay,
and I read everyone.
And your website is sixkiller.com.
Right.
And that's spelled exactly how it sounds.
Right.
All right. Well,
one word.
I thank you for spending time with us. Like I said, this book is fantastic.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. And I thank you for reading my book and being so knowledgeable about, you know, interviewer. I appreciate it.
Well, I highly recommend it to people. There's a diversity of stories here. And, you know, you can make of it what you want. But like I said, I generally tend to believe people when they tell me stories. I don't think most people go through that much trouble to make stuff up. And usually you can tell if someone's telling you a fake story. There have been a few times over the years where I've gone, I'm not totally sure about this person, but I always give them the benefit of the doubt because I wasn't there. I don't know. All we have is their word to take on it. And so many of these stories tell the same basic things in a sense. I mean, they're very different stories, but you have a lot of common elements in there, too.
Yes, you do.
So... All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Artie.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate it. And if you want to keep in touch or you want me to come back, I'd be happy to do that.
All right. Fantastic. All right. And to take you out tonight, we're going to hear some Eliza. You know, I never know how to say that. Eliza Rickman. E-L-I-Z-A Rickman. And you can find her on Bandcamp if you're interested in this. This is a song called Maker of My Sorrow.